Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the Bristol Men and Earliest Network podcast. Today we are joined by Dr. Simon Brownhill, a senior teaching associate in the Faculty of Education at the University of Cambridge. We'll be talking about the notion of male role models, the gender gap, and the professionalism of early years, amongst other things. Hope you enjoy. So hello, welcome Simon. Thanks for joining us on the Bristol Men and Earliest Network podcast.
Thank you.
Could you start by providing our viewers with some of your background?
I started out as a primary school teacher and I specialised in 3 to 7 as part of my degree. Went into a primary school teaching and was a year one teacher for a year and then somehow got a reception post in a brand new school. So I had the chance to create my own learning environment. So I remember the night before the school opening, painting the walls because it wasn't finished. And having to unpack all these resources, I've got all these catalogues that I could choose, and I was there for 3 years. And one day I was asked to go and teach phonics at Derby University and ended up with a job. And so worked on the B.Ed and PGCE course for 5 years and set up the PGCE early years route for 3. And then decided to go back into school, and I was an assistant head teacher for early years in a large inner city primary school. And I worked in a foundation unit with 120 children. So my ears are still ringing now. And then the university contacted me and said they wanted me back. And so I made the move back to university where I worked on a foundation degree for children and young people services, working very much with teaching assistants and childcare workers, which I absolutely loved. And then somehow I got a job at Cambridge University, working as part of an international development team where I work primarily with professionals in Kazakhstan. And one of the things that I advocate strongly is good early years practice in terms of helping to train teachers in terms of good pedagogy. And then I'm here today to do this podcast with you.
Thank you. So has it always been early years for you? Could it ever have been secondary school?
I thought about secondary, but at the time they were taller than me, so I thought no. And I just remember going into a primary school when I was doing my A-levels, and it was like a drug. I absolutely loved it, and I found I loved it more the lower I went down the school. And I just felt very much at home, particularly with early years. And I think I quite like getting messy. That's one thing I really enjoy. So I don't know, it's just something, I suppose you just sort of click with it. And I always remember being told, oh, you're a man, you'll get a job. And then I thought, okay, well, that's one sort of buy-in for it. But it was the joy of being able to teach young children something that they would know for the rest of their life, be it being able to write their first name or being able to count to 5. I think for me, that's the most important thing. And one of my proudest things, and I always say this to any students that I work with, that when I die on my tombstone, I will have written, here lies Simon Brownhill. He taught 90 children to read and write. And no one can ever take that away from me, because it was that building block of moving them forward.
I think there's something about early years where the development is so fast, it's really rewarding because you are moving on these children at such a rate. Without forcing it, they're just sort of sponges.
Absolutely. Incredible. And when you've got them, they've got that love of learning, that makes your job so much easier. And because then I like to play and be creative and all those sorts of things. You can get real children to really buy in. And I think people used to sort of say, what do you do as a job? And I used to be quite embarrassed to say I was a teacher. I used to say I was a dolphin trainer. It was more interesting. But now I say I sell education. And in essence, any professional who works in early years primary, in education full stop, is a salesperson. You sell learning to them, and it's how you sell it to them, and that's your job. And for me, that's the biggest buzz, is how am I going to get these young children to be able to learn X, Y, and Z, you
know, and want to learn as well.
That's right. And because they're so keen and they're so young, they don't know any better, so you've got that chance to be able to really get that love of learning. You know, we talk about, you know, lifelong learning, whatever. Well, for children, it's just there. And it's about nurturing that, and that's, you know, the most important thing.
But it's still very much learning through play, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's that massive transition.
And we all learn through play, but for some reason, our education system sort of changes that. So as soon as they sort of leave reception, it's a kind of chalk and talk, sit at a table, and we kind of kill children's love of learning. And for me, that's very hard to accept.
That first time of year one, I always feel sad for those children that I've worked with in reception, and I see it hit them in the afternoons that they're not going to get that plan do review time or play time or whatever you want to
That's
call
right.
it.
That's right. And, you know, I particularly like the way that the Welsh government has sort of advocated this notion of play running all the way through to seven. But actually, it should be all the way through. So even though I work at university and I've worked with principals, head teachers, trainers, I still use a play-based learning approach at different levels to engage those learners. And they respond very much to it. So, you know, I go to Kazakhstan with a bag of balloons, which I know sounds absolutely crazy, but I can generate questions and answers and activities by them using that resource. Young children respond to it, and we can respond to it if we embrace that active way of learning.
Yeah, it's definitely a great incentive if you have something that's enjoyable.
Well, the stats show that if you are educating adults, for example, after 19 minutes of talking to them, they'll switch off and think about other things. So you've got to think realistically about your learning. Now, for children, you've got exactly the same problem because their attention span is like their age plus one. So you've really got to be quick on the mark to capture, you know, what they can do and really get the learning for.
Moving on to the reason why we've got you here and some of your work involving role models and particularly unpacking what's meant by a role model, could you give us a basic introduction?
My research was sort of triggered by my time in school, and I remember being at the brand new school and a parent saying to me, "You are the perfect role model for my child." And I was just elated. I remember walking home from school, my ego was huge. And that evening I sat and thought, well, what does that mean? So I went back to the parent the next day and said, "I'm really puzzled, you know, what did you mean by that?" And she said, "I don't know." And I thought, how odd that somebody uses a phrase like that but can't define it. And it stuck in my mind. So after I completed my master's, I decided to do my doctoral research, 6 long years, of trying to explore what the role model is and what it actually means. And after 6 years, I still don't have an answer because it's a hugely ambiguous term and we all bring different meanings to the word. So if you break up the words, you've got role model, role. So first of all, you've got to try and define what you mean by role. So what is it that somebody or something is doing? So what are those roles? Well, when you just say that you're a role model, you don't actually define those. So the role could be a leader, or it could be a carer, or it could
Contextual.
So you've got the issue of context or expectations, because your expectation of a role model might be different to a parent's expectation, might be different to a centre manager's, etc. So you've got that. And then you've got model. So, you know, you could look at it as a model as in a male model, but that's not what we're sort of talking about here. So what is the person modelling? So is it leadership qualities? Is it empathetic qualities? Is it the physical being modelling of clothing or, you know, humour or that sort of stuff? Put the two words together and you just exacerbate the issues further. So what is it? And where then when you put the word male in front of it, which is typically used when we're talking about men working in early years, a male role model, what is that? Is it a man being a role model, or is it the role model emulating male characteristics like masculinity, hegemonic masculinity, which is very strong and dominant?
Yeah.
Or is it, so you've got all these different ways of looking at it, which just makes the term so difficult. But it's frequently and freely used in public and professional discourse. But there isn't a clear definition. So you can go to lots of different sources. So trying to unpack that makes it very, very hard. But we have it in policy documents, we have it used in the media. But what does it mean? And that's what I'm still trying to find out.
Well, maybe moving on to the policy direction, I've got the DfE's workforce strategy. And it's quite prominent on the idea of there needing to be an increased amount of men within the early years. And it's pointed to sort of studies from 2008 that suggest that there are lots of children that don't have interactions with men. Therefore,
we need more male role models, and that seems like quite a leap within itself. How would you like to see that change, perhaps, in the way that we're setting up policies? How can we think about role models in those regards?
I think that the research that you're reporting on that's in that document is from 2008, so we're now in 2017. We're nearly a decade on. So does that still stand? Yes, there are assertions that children are growing up in men deserts, but it's difficult to accept that just putting a man in front of children is going to make the difference. Because the kicker is that children don't actually look to practitioners or teachers as role models, particularly young children, because the concept is just beyond their capability to understand. So if you asked a three-year-old what a role model is, they wouldn't be able to tell you. So research that was done by Bacena and Thornton that looked at the perceptions of role models of children aged 7 to 8, the least likely person that they would look to as a role model was their teacher, because we don't actually want to grow up to be like our teachers. So Walker talks about role models being generationally, geographically and experientially close to the child. So you are more likely to look to near peers as the thing that you model. So like the older brother, for example, yeah, or somebody who's that sort of a little bit mature. That whole idea of sort of, let's say, like pop stars and film stars is beyond a lot of children's sort of aspirations, because there isn't, they're sort of not based in reality, it's too far apart. So I have a real issue about this idea that putting the man in the classroom is going to be the answer, because there's no assertion that they're going to be any good. And I worry very much about settings, local authorities trying to get some sort of men quota. So, you know, two people go for a job, one of them is a man, one is a woman, and the man gets it because of his gender. But it actually turns out that the man isn't good. Actually, what are we employing people on? Are we employing them based on their gender or their ability to practice? If we don't get the best people for early years, there is just no point. So it has to be based on your capabilities, because you can't have a job description that says must be male. There's no assertion that you've got that. There is also a issue about that children don't come into contact with men, and the research actually says that they do, but they come into contact with them in lots of different ways. So you might have a child, yeah, who's been brought up in a single parent family, but there may be uncles or you know, wider family members, grandparents that are in that child's life, so they're coming into contact with them, and then in that way they go on the bus, they'll see the bus driver. They'll go to the shops and there'll be the shopkeeper there. They'll see the fireman in the, or the fire person, you know, in the fire engine. So actually children do come into contact with in a lot of different ways. And also looking at the TV programmes that they engage with, there are characters that are male based. So there is that contact. And it's questionable about the impact of, you know, increasing these number of men, because you've got children that might be in a 2.4 family, for example, but their dad might be abusive to them. So is it a good thing that that child's got that man in their life? I don't think so. It could be distant, you know, it could be working away for ages. So yeah, he might be in their life, but he's not around. So we've still got that issue. And I always think of the idea of a non-traditional family. So a child that's brought up by two women, for example, is that child experiencing a deficient upbringing based on, you know, the gender of the parent, so to speak? Clearly not. I mean, in the document, it talks about a positive male role model. But what does it mean to be a positive role model? What is it that man is supposed to be modelling? And there's a real issue and tension about what is expected for them to model versus what they're able to. Yeah. So I look at my own experience that one of the big things is about these men serving as father figures. Okay, well, when I started teaching at 21, I wasn't able, capable, or particularly willing to take on that role, largely because I was trying to battle with how do I survive a day with these children, and then how do you actually act as a father with those children? And there is that sort of juxtaposition between how a practitioner works versus a father figure, and you've got that real tension about what expectations are there. So what is positive? Because what might be positive as sort of like, from one person's perspective, a parent might want the man to be a disciplinarian, but for some they might want him to be a very empathetic, nurturing man. So you've got different expectations that make it even harder. So that document just exacerbates the issue of role model, because it doesn't clearly stipulate, you know, if you've got job description, it says what your roles are. There is nothing that actually sets that out for any man working in the sector or wanting to work in the sector to know what a positive role model is.
Sure.
And that links in with sort of wider issues of masculinity and what it means to be, you know, a man, particularly in the early years, but, you know, in wider society.
Yeah. So you've got, on the one side, this notion, Connell talks about hegemonic masculinity, which is the subscription to a very dominant way of being, that you're very strong, aggressive, disciplinarian, you know, a man's man, so to speak. Well, you put that sort of man into early years and that's just not going to work. So then you have sort of non-hegemonic masculinities, and that's where you have a very sort of softer approach, very caring, very nurturing, very empathetic. And then there's that sort of tension whether you're going to be perceived as gay, or, you know, some parents may see it in the sense, or potential paedophile, because all those stigmas are attached, or others where you are a manager in waiting, you're only actually doing this to get into a management role. So you have those sorts of lines of inquiry which make it very difficult. So what kind of masculinities do you model? Well, Deborah Jones talks about the idea of the millennium man, the man who can cry, can wear pink, but is quite sort of strong in terms of who he is. And you've got this tension of what the man is able to do and what is expected of them. And I will remember when the new school that I opened, the assertion was is that I would be the PE coordinator. I hate PE. Yeah. I had to learn how to play football. I couldn't do that.
Presumably you can play football.
Of course, because I'm a bloke. No. For me, it was about music and dance and drama and the creative arts. That was the thing that I was really interested in. I was also DT coordinator. I mean, I can't get a door handle to work for me sometimes. So how am I going to cope with that? So it's that assertion that your gender will dictate how you operate.
I think what they're trying to get at with this is the fact that we're seeing boys fail, or that's how we're sort of writing it up at the minute. The academic attainment is lower, the likelihood to turn to crime is higher, violent acts higher as well. There seems to be two differing strategies to fixing this. One is targeting boys, some might say exacerbating the binary, and then the other one is a more holistic approach and realising that it's a problem larger with our society. So where do you fit on that scale?
Well, the issue with boys and academic attainment has always existed. So the House of Commons Education Committee, they looked in 2014 at the gap between boys and girls, and it is from earliest foundation stage, key stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's the same for degrees as well. It's always been the case. So saying that it is, you know, this sort of epidemic is not really the case, because we've always had this issue. This golden age of men working in the sector is crazy, because you look at it in the 19th century and it was 12% of men who were working in primary schools. What have we got now? 15. So things haven't changed. In the early years, it's always been between 2-3%. You've got this issue about targeting boys, because interestingly, in the 90s, it was actually girls that were considered to be the ones that were underachieving. So it's almost like a cyclical sort of approach where the girls are actually targeted. And particularly, like at the moment, we're targeting them with the STEM subjects, you know, because they're sort of something like that. But it's not working. So it's very difficult, because it's almost like we don't do anything about it and just let boys sort of get on. I don't know where I sit on it, because I think good pedagogy is good pedagogy, full stop. And I think that the beauty of early years foundation stage is that it is meant to target the whole child. And for me, that's very, very important. I think the issue that you've got is that there's this huge drive in terms of attainment, which is targeting particularly with literacy and numeracy, which means that the sort of social and emotional and creative and all those sides of the child sort of get lost, and we know that they're so important. And I think that it's interesting, because Ashley in 2001 says, you know, good teaching is good teaching, so whatever you do for the girls, you can do for the boys, because they'll buy into it. And it's true. It's all about the sell, how you sell it to children. So I don't think there's an easy answer. I just think it comes down to good teaching and being invested in the whole child. I don't necessarily buy into the whole idea of learning styles and teaching styles.
The article in The Guardian recently said that there has been no evidence for learning styles.
What it does is it helps you to think about the way in which you are educating the child or giving them the experience to engage in it. And I think it's quite useful to think. I always think of multiple intelligences is a nice way of thinking about whether you're providing for the whole suite of things. But it's a very good question, one that I don't particularly know the answer to. In terms of addressing the issue with boys and their failing, I think that we need to think very much about how we acquire that attainment. I think, you know, personally, I was just dreadful at exams, and whether that's a boy trait, a man trait, I don't know. But I think that trying to think about different ways of demonstrating learning is absolutely crucial. I don't think we can get away with this issue with the writing, for example, but it's all about how you make boys want to write. And so it's about the way that pedagogy works as opposed to how we do it.
It's interesting that boys' sort of attainment is lower than girls, and it always has been, you know, from early years, preschool, secondary, and in university, you know, more girls are going to university. But in the workforce...
And getting better degree classifications as well.
And they are, but, you know, the gender wage gap, more men are in higher roles.
You know,
we still have inequality based off gender, so
absolutely.
There's a real sort of problem there, I guess, you know, that we're failing children widely in schools, but actually when we got into wider society... Men are still very much on top.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just wonder to what extent we're able to sort of challenge that in the early years and try and get that balance right from the start and promote more equitable practices towards the big picture here.
I think it's very hard to do that because it's not that we're setting these children up to fail, but the sort of experiences they have in the early years are not going to replicate what they'll get in real life. So it's about it's sort of expectations of Ross. My sister's pregnant, she's going to have a baby in 4 weeks' time, and it's interesting that she will have the year off to look after the child, whereas dad will only get 2 weeks paternity, which is just, you know, how does that work? Because it's this sort of 19th century sort of mindset of the man is the breadwinner and the woman is the bread maker. So I think it's about that's the issue. I think it's about the media thinking about the way that they present things. I mean, I would love to see this sort of notion of describing a woman as a female role model. How often do you see that?
Yeah.
You never hear that. You hear, he's a role model for my child, but it's not the same. And I think it's about choice as well. I mean, I always go back to my reception class and, you know, would actively encourage the boys to dress up in women's clothing and to be mum in the role play area, and they encourage the girls if they wanted to play with the hammer and nails, and advocating those sort of practices, you know, that you can do it, and giving them those options. But it's interesting, research is very clear that children have got very distinctive ideas about what a girl, what a boy is from the age of two, and whether that's nature or nurture is, you know, questionable. So you've actually got to think about what we're doing, you know, in those formative years. That's really important. So the play resources that they have, the choices that are available, the way that professionals offer those to children, I think is absolutely crucial. And also ensuring that parents and carers understand why we are practicing the way that they are. Because you've got this tension, haven't you, between what will happen in an early year setting, and then they go home, and what happens there. And so is mum chained to the sink and dad is sat in front of the television, in terms of those roles, you've always got that tension between the two.
What do you make of research that show pre-social sex differences? I don't know if you've come across his stuff. So I think some of it involves showing pre-social children a picture of a face and a ball, inanimate object, and research shows that boys are more likely to look at balls and girls are more likely to look at faces.
Fascinating, really. I mean, but you've also got this sort of issue, you know, instances like certain cultures looking at people's faces actually discouraged. So you've got that, you know, cultural expectations can affect the way that we practice. So, I mean, certainly interesting research, but not something I could comment on now.
I'm interested in sort of the notion of professionalism of the early years workforce.
Yeah.
To what extent, you know, that plays a part in how important we see early years as challenging societal norms and inequality from the start. And there is that sort of notion that parents don't always see the early years as very important compared to school, whereas actually, you know, all the research shows that it's a crucial stage in the child's development.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when I first started, the early years didn't have a status, didn't have a curriculum. It was just sort of optional. So for you to have the curriculum guidance for the foundation stages, it's actually have that little pink folder. I've still got mine. It fell to bits. And then you've got the early years foundation stage documents. I mean, that's just fantastic that we got that. I think the issue that you've got is where you have settings that are connected to schools that get drawn into the target-driven agenda. And what that does is that saps the quality practice. And then you've got professionals who are having that tussle between embracing quality early years practice and playing the targets game. And I think that's very hard. I totally agree with you. It's about parents understanding that children don't have to come from a session with some homework to do, because that's not how it works, and that they don't have to have something written down, and that a picture can say 1,000 words. And I think opening the doors to allow parents in to see what happens and to understand why, because no one teaches you to be a parent. So, you know, how can we expect parents and carers to understand what we do, because we are the professionals, and it's about educating them as well. And I think you're absolutely right that it's helping them to understand and finding ways of communicating. I mean, a lot of people are very resistant to cross the threshold, the door, because of their own experiences. So finding ways to get them in is just really key. But also the ways that we communicate with parents and carers as well, you know, because you can put things in a newsletter, but people are not going to read it. So how you use displays, how you use social media, thinking of creative, innovative ways to do that is really key.
Especially in this area of Bristol, accommodating different languages is a major thing that I think a lot of schools don't do properly.
No. I mean, by the school that I was the assistant head at, there were 36 languages spoke. So in order to produce a newsletter that everyone could access was really tricky. And, you know, Google Translate can only do so much.
So talking about raising the status of early years, in Cleverlands, and the name of the author escapes me in a minute, she suggests one of the major reasons for Finland's success isn't just the system, but it's also the investment that parents make. And that's why they can go without learning to read officially until sort of the age of 7, because they're actually doing that at home. And
mm-hmm.
Do you think there is a way we can shift perspective and make early years more important and not just relegate play as this sort of superficial thing and take it as important as it is?
I think there are a number of ways of doing it. I think actually making it come to fruition is extremely hard, because you've got systems and structures that have been placed that are grounded in historical understanding and practices and ideas and theories and that sort of stuff. I mean, from the Finnish perspective, you know, the government encourages parents to stay at home. Our government encourages parents to go back to work. So there's that tension there. Consumer society, you know, we all want the flat screen TVs and the nice holidays and stuff, and the only way you can do that is by getting the money, so that's an issue. You've also got a difference in terms of family structures, you know, the work that I do in Kazakhstan, for example, you know, tremendously family orientated, whereas a lot of children, you know, the families that, you know, they come from are quite disparate and sort of broken, and that sort of network that supports children, I think, is really key. So it's not an easy answer. In terms of raising the status, it's got to come from the top down. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I think government has got to recognise the importance of it, to actually see what it can do. And it's right, you know, it's the foundation. And if you build on rocky foundations, we're always going to be battling with the issues if education is supposed to be about passing a test, which it seems to think so. So I think it's got to be like a top-down perspective in terms of looking at the policies and what they say. And it can't all be about money. I mean, I don't think anyone goes into early years for the money, but there has to be some sort of reward from it. And there's only so many thank you cards that you can get. Actually, you do have to pay your bills. And I think by raising the money, that says something about the value of the work that you do. But education as a whole is sort of like quite poorly paid. But from the bottom up as well, you know, about professionals actually advocating what they do. I find that students that I work with, when they have to sort of do their assignments, are quite timid and reserved in terms of expressing the successes that they had. And I actually think that it's the opportunity, sort of, not to blow your own trumpet, but to actually say, I've done a good job here. Because if anything goes wrong, well, it's the professional's fault. But actually advocating what's gone well, what we're doing well, and promoting that and raising that status in terms of looking at the achievements, not only of the children, but also the staff, I think is important. So you've actually got two ways of looking at it, a top-down and a bottom-up as well. And I think that would be really key potential ways, you know, investment in time, money, training particularly, I think is absolutely crucial, keeping people in the loop with good quality practice, not fads. And I think we're too quick to jump on the bandwagon of advocated approaches because we think it's a sort of quick fix, it's like a sticky plaster, you know, if we do this it'll address this issue. And actually it's thinking more long term about the benefits and looking at the research to actually see whether it works or not.
It's satisfying to plant a flag there and say, I installed this program and I can put my name behind it there, isn't it? Just as we finish up, would you like to just briefly go over your future projects, what you're doing at the minute? Maybe briefly touch on what you're doing in Kazakhstan as well.
One of the things that there's two main things. One is that I'm writing a book with David Wright from Southampton, which is about men in early years. We've got a title, but it's in inverted commas because we don't like it, but the publishers do. And it's actually looking at the lived experiences, and we're trying to write a book that combines the academic with the professional. And one of the things we want to do is to use real case studies, vignettes, scenarios that help people to problematize some of the issues that men face, and thinking about the way that we actually practice and the reasons why we do things and what we can do to change things, not in a big way, but little small things, little victories, I think we're going to call it. So that's got to be in for January next year, so I must start writing something for that. And then I undertook some research last year, which I'm in the process of analysing and writing up as a paper, which is about role models revisited. So my obsession of my own doctoral research, I've sort of asked the same questions but nearly a decade on, and looking at people's perceptions of what the role model is, and they're exactly the same. Things have not changed. And
so
it's,
you're just going to reprint?
Yeah, you can't do that. It's not allowed. I have looked. But it's actually reporting on people's perceptions, and it's a comparison actually of trainees' perceptions of role model versus those that are in the profession, and actually looking at the similarities and differences. And it's quite worrying how mindsets remain the same. And it makes me question about whether we can actually make change really happen, given educated people and the way that they think and the way that they operate. So those are the two things that I am looking to do. I think that's where I'm at.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for your time. It's been
my pleasure.
Lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Great.
If you'd like to contact us, please send an email to bmiey@bristol.gov.uk or to find us on Twitter @bmieynetwork. Bye for now.